things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah!
That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
But that's something they don't tell you about getting old.
No.
They tell you about, like, the back pain
uh-huh.
and the exhaustion. They don't tell you that, like, your schedule for planning gets longer and longer.
There is no more at 2 o'clock today. Let's plan on going out dancing at 10 o'clock.
No, you can't text me Monday and be like, what are you doing this weekend? Like, my weekend has been spoken for 4 weeks.
Yeah. I need to know about this at least 15 business days ahead of time. Like, 10 might be able to squeeze it in.
Mm.
But
week of, sus. It's not happening.
No.
My time is accounted for.
And you know what I think?
What?
Who canceled on you that you suddenly have this time available? And how am I your second choice?
But I am a first choice as long as you plan accordingly.
Accurate. Oh my gosh. This weekend I have a wedding.
Okay.
And they were like, just move it. And I was like, to what? When?
And move the wedding?
No, move tonight. Like, move recording.
Oh, what?
And
when?
I know. And the thing that I love, and I love so many people support us in this, but I think that some people just don't understand that we have a schedule and we do stick to it.
And we have to, though.
And we have to. And we've been doing this for 6 months and we have never not put out an episode.
No.
And
we are going to stick
by this.
Listen, you got to.
We made a promise to each other.
And now to like 100 strangers on the internet that we're going to put out something to listen to every Friday.
When you say it, it sounds so funny.
I made a promise to you and 100 people. I don't know.
So when somebody says, just move it, I was like, you do not understand. But this is, we have created a second job for ourselves.
Oh,
and
my
you
God.
Can't call in sick.
How long do you think that we spend on the podcast a week? I was trying to, like, think about it with Ian the other day. I probably spend, like, 3 hours per research story.
Yeah.
And we probably spend... but, I mean, there's, like, a little bit of, like, rapscallion shenanigans, like, on recording nights. Because, like, we have to eat and then we have to, like, catch up.
And then we have to drink and then we have to watch TikToks.
Yep.
I mean, for me, because I edit, that also adds...
Oh, yeah.
Like, probably, like, 2 hours. And then anything for the Instagram is probably, like, another 2 hours. I would say I probably spend 8 hours a week.
That's fair.
Eight.
I would say... about the same, but I'm not as efficient at research as you are. Again,
I don't know if I would call myself
music
efficient.
Major. Communications major over there on the other side of the table.
You know what I found that was actually very beneficial to me in this research for today's disaster episode? Did you just eat a fucking Rolo?
The last one.
I can't.
It sounded like you were on a roll, and I thought I had a couple seconds to chew.
I was on a roll, but then you looked like a deer in the headlights, like you were getting to get in trouble.
I thought you were going to yell at me for eating a Rolo, which you did.
I wouldn't have. You wouldn't have looked so suspect.
I'm not sneaky.
Oh, my God. So, okay. Finding out that I watched YouTube videos as a lot of this research instead of reading articles.
Okay.
And I hand wrote my notes first, and then I typed them out today, and it was a lot easier, actually.
Oh.
So I might continue this. I don't know. It was
okay.
It was a little different detour that I took this time.
Whenever I do an episode where my research comes from primarily YouTube videos, because I have a very impressive words per minute typing.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I will slow it down to 0.75. You can slow down YouTube videos.
Shut up.
And you can type as they talk.
Shut up.
And then you can go back through and add in your talking points and your... Yeah.
Homie, you just changed my life. Ooh,
game changer over here.
Mm, I love that.
This is how we evolve.
Love a research tip.
Uh-huh. Mm. You're welcome.
Oh, man. So welcome to a disastrous episode.
Welcome to A Little Bit Grim. It's a podcast you're listening to right now.
Congratulations, you found us. Welcome home.
That's Taylor over there.
That's Jenny on the other side of the table.
Oh, hey.
And we're very happy to have you.
We are happy to have you.
Welcome to our passion project.
It really is. I just very often think about the two girls back in February before coronavirus, before 2020. Really got underway and we're like, let's do a podcast.
And the other one was like, yeah. And then we did it.
And now we're doing it like a full 9 months later.
Yeah. It's proud insane. I'm proud of us.
I'm proud of us too, but mostly I'm proud of the people who have stuck with us.
Absolutely.
And have continued to listen. Because I think if like we had four people listening and it was like me, Taylor, Ian, and maybe
Allie.
And Allie. I cannot.
Nothing against Ian or Allie. Thank you for being here.
Taylor and I can sit around and listen to ourselves talk all day.
Absolutely.
We continue to do this because we love the idea that other people also like it. So thank you so much.
In the work group chat, somebody in my team at work said, after a long day of training, does anybody get tired of hearing their own voice? And I said, I'm a podcaster. No.
No. The name of the game is not getting sick of listening to my own voice. One of my coworkers.
Narcissism at its best.
One of my coworkers the other day, she like spontaneously she like has listened to like one or two episodes, but she just found out that over Halloween weekend, she is staying at the Congress Plaza Hotel in Chicago. And I was like, oh my God, girl, that's haunted. And she was like, what? So she pulled up. We are sitting in a small office and she's like, do you mind if I pull up the episode where you guys talk about the Congress Plaza Hotel? And I was like, I mean, okay.
You are welcome to.
Only because it was Taylor's story and I didn't have to listen to my own voice. And she turned it off as soon as my part came on. And I was like, thank you.
Oh my goodness. Did I tell you that Ryan listened to an episode, but it was because I forced him?
What episode?
It was Folklore.
Okay. Did he hate it?
No. He was like, you guys are very funny.
I know. We also think we're funny.
But then he was like, you know what I think is extra funny? And Jenny and I have talked about this through the group or through our chat. But the best part of editing an episode is when Jenny tells a joke and my brain is the same brain that recorded in the moment. And I think the joke in my head and then I say it out loud and then it makes me laugh. And
I do it also all the time when I listen back to like your final edits. I'll like hear you say something and I'm like, and then in the podcast I go,
that's amazing. It's my favorite. And then it was especially, I thought the Folklore episode, it was cracking me up while I was editing it. And so I was laughing along with some of the stupid shit we were talking about. And because I still think it's funny secondhand. And I would laugh the same way. Like, if you said something stupid and I was, like, exasperated at you, I'd be like, and I would do it out loud. And Ryan was like, have you listened to this enough times that you're, like,
mimicking?
Yeah. And I was like, no, it's authentic. That's how I laugh at Jenny. And he was like, I can't with you guys.
It really is. Listen, if you want to do some, like, any deep self-exploration into, like, ego or personality, start a podcast.
It's an interesting time.
It's been riveting. Uncomfortable, but like also very interesting.
Yeah, I'm feeling my Slytherin self kind of a little bit. Like
it's because ambitious. We got that Scorpio Mercury retrograde sneaking up on ya.
That tornado volcano.
Ooh, girl, she coming. Ooh, girl, she coming.
I love that in the Facebook group, people just tag you in tornadoes.
Yes, you love it because it reminds you of me. I love it because I fucking love tornadoes. tornadoes.
No, I
we're getting ready. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm about to talk about tornadoes for a second. Many people don't know that here in northern Indiana, and also in more eastern northern places with like a cooler, more temperate climate, we have a second tornado season. Did you know it's coming up? It starts the middle of October to the middle of November. And we very oftentimes get the most severe thunderstorms because it is warm fronts meeting with Arctic cool fronts that clash when they meet over us, and they create like rotation in the upper atmosphere.
I love the joy in your voice, but let me kindly remind you that your workplace was hit by a tornado.
Oh, I know. Listen. I understand the devastation caused by tornadoes. I do. They can really fluff some shit up.
Yes, they can.
Yes, they can.
And let me be clear. I love a tornado, too. I love tornadoes. I love Jenny. I love that Jenny loves tornadoes. I do not know the tornado facts like Jenny does. She can tell you why and the how and mm-hmm. the when. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I just want to be in awe of it.
I can tell you 3 days in advance because I stalk the National Weather Service like a 16-year-old stalks Harry Styles, okay? I follow them every day, mm-hmm. and I know when there is instability in the upper atmosphere. I will tell you 3 days in advance, like, watch out, we're going to get, like, a code 2, like, possibility for, like, tornado watch. I just like to predict it. I do the same with snowstorms. You're going to get a yes. whole different version of me in the winter.
I love a snowstorm, except when I have to travel in it. I'm going to Iowa next week, and I always get stuck in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
So I'll keep you posted if I make it out of Iowa.
Let's do a giveaway.
Oh, okay.
Okay. For I don't know what we're going to give away.
Okay.
Something.
No, but tell me the things.
Go onto the Facebook group.
Yep.
And guess what day the first accumulated snowfall will happen in Indiana.
In Fort Wayne, Indiana.
In Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And how much is accumulation?
Accumulated snow is a half inch or more.
Okay.
It doesn't have to stick around for any certain period of time, but this is a very... I'm not going to, like, give you any, like, helpful hints, but just know that the ground temperature has to be below freezing for the snow to accumulate to that much. The ground temperature.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay.
Great. Let's do it.
Okay.
We'll figure out something to give away. We're probably going to have to rope in Ian on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, if you know anything about Ian, you may know a little bit about what we may give away.
We've mentioned it, like, once, maybe in a very early episode.
Right. So, we'll see.
We'll get with you.
All right.
Post it on the Facebook. I will make an Excel spreadsheet of your guesses.
I love that.
Okay.
Great. Okay. Do you want to get us started with a disaster tonight?
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of
snowstorm, I'm going to tell you about a disaster that is not, well, I can't say it's not weather related because it is, but it's not a snowstorm and it is not a tornado.
It's not cold.
It's not cold. It's quite the opposite of cold.
I can't wait.
I have a couple different sources, a lot of Wikipedia, of course, 77 article by Rain No, which is a metal name. And then a couple other that when we post on the Instagram will be included in the screenshots.
Amazing.
So in the 1920s.
Ooh. Old.
Old. The ancient.
Prehistoric.
If you wanted to cross the Atlantic, you got on a big old boat. A industry which just a few years prior to this had their own little scandal involving an iceberg. But in the 1930s, flying transatlantic on an airship was the fastest and most luxurious thing you could possibly do. In a modern-day cruise ship that gently floats and bobs across the skies and delivers you safe and sound into paradise.
Hold on. Are you, This is not an airplane?
This, oh, no, oh, nay, nay.
You're going over the Atlantic Ocean in a flying contraption that is not an airplane.
Correct.
Okay.
I think it is very steampunk.
I am not okay with it.
This is like, for lack of a better word, it's like a it's a blimp. Luxury. Okay.
Are you serious?
This is the end all be all. Like, this was a industry that was just getting traction. It was putting like luxury cruise liners out of fucking business because they were faster, they were more efficient, they were more luxurious. I'm about to tell you all about it.
Honestly, sounds great.
Germany. Maniacal laughing. And Germany set up the world's first transatlantic air service for passengers, launching the Graf Zeppelin, the world's largest airship at the time. And in 1930, it could fly you all the way from Germany to Brazil.
What?
You would leave Friedrichshafen on Saturday night and arrive in Rio de Janeiro on Thursday morning.
Oh my God.
Five, six days. Take you all the way from Germany to Brazil.
Sounds good.
Right. And normally that would be like a month-long trip on a ship.
Really?
Yes. To go from Germany across the Atlantic all the way down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because you, this way in a blimp, you could like go as the crow flies.
You know what I saw in TJ Maxx the other day that I said we should have that in the podcast room?
What?
A globe.
I would love that. I would
prefer it was black and white. It was chalk.
Ooh.
And I was like, in my head, I was like, I might need this for the future. And then I walked away from it.
Oh, you shouldn't have.
I know. I regret it.
It's okay. We'll go back. By 1936, Germany had produced an even bigger blimp, the Hindenburg, which began shuttling passengers, cargo, and mail from Frankfurt to New Jersey and back. The ship could carry 50 people initially and later 72 passengers, and would carry a crew of 40 to 60 people. The trip took about 4 days in each direction, and make no mistake, it was for rich passengers only. A one-way ticket was $400.
RPO. Rich passengers only.
RPO. Rich people only. And that translates in like real-time money to $7,050.
Wow.
This was for the rich and famous.
And I think that's similar to what the Queen Mary was, right?
It was up there. Was it?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're talking the same caliber of people.
Correct. So what did you get for your money?
Please tell me.
First off, the travel time was almost a day faster than going by ship, just going from Germany to New Jersey.
Okay.
Not to Brazil. Plus, there was no chance he'd get seasick. The liftoff procedure was so gentle that passengers who weren't paying attention reportedly didn't realize they had left the ground.
Smooth.
Smooth freaking sailing. Once in flight, the voyage was said to be so smooth that you could balance a pencil on the table. Speaking of tables, you ate the kind of luxury chow that one might find at a traditional high-end European hotel. According to Alice Obscura, pointing out that the chef on the final Hindenburg voyage was from the Ritz in Pelly.
Mm.
I have a menu. From NPR.
All right. So, I love a menu.
I know. So, beef broth with marrow dumplings.
Oh.
And Rhine salmon. A la Graf Zeppelin.
Seafood.
It's the example of a typical airship meal if you had a European palate. The food was freaking stellar.
Bomb.com.
Airplane food sucks because high altitudes deaden our taste buds. But the Hindenburg flew just 330 to 650 feet off the ground.
How many?
330 feet.
Huh?
So what's that? Like 30 stories?
Well, a football field is...
Taylor, don't get us into this.
No, it's...
100 yards.
No.
Yes.
A football field is 360 yards, or 360 feet.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
That's 100 yards.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
I think so. God damn
it. Yeah, 50-yard line. Yeah. It's not 100 feet. It's 100 yards.
Okay.
So a football field is 360 feet.
So basically it floated one football field off the ground. One or two football fields.
Okay. That makes... Okay. Yep.
Yeah. So just very gentle blooping along.
And thank God for no skyscrapers.
Right. Well, most of the time we're over the ocean.
Can you imagine like looking down and seeing dolphins?
Well, so the passenger areas were not pressurized except for one single room. I'll get to that in a moment. So you could open the windows. Because you're floating at like a lower altitude. You can open the windows and like hang your head out and like look at the dolphins and look at the ocean as you like gently bleep bloop across the Atlantic.
Honestly, I'm going to be real. This sounds like the future.
It does. And that's what the people at the time thought, that this was the luxury way to travel. Like airplanes were utilitarian. You got from one place to another really, really quickly. This was the way to get somewhere in style.
Listen, if I didn't know that this ended horribly because it's a disaster episode.
You don't even know how it ends.
It can't end well.
It doesn't. Because
this is no longer a thing. And we're in a disasters episode.
Yes. There's a reason why we don't do blimps.
But if we did blimps, I would be on board.
Honestly, sign me up. Same. Same. Okay. I even know how this ends. And I'm like, we didn't really give it an old college try.
Can you imagine if we just stopped flying airplanes after one airplane crash?
And just everybody boop bops. Oh my God. I wish airplanes scare the snot out of me.
I know they do.
Okay. So the lounge contained a grand piano made from aluminum to save weight.
What?
Uh-huh.
Brilliant.
The kitchen was downstairs and all heat sources were electric. Food was shuttled upstairs by a dumbwaiter that led to a pantry off of the dining room. The passenger cabins were pretty cozy and a little utilitarian, featuring two bunks, like in the sleeper compartment of a train. Each room did, however, have its own sink with both hot and cold running water. The toilets and shower were downstairs, as was the bar. And yes, you could booze and cruise on this bad boy.
I love that.
Beyond the bar was a two-door airlock that held the single pressurized room, which was incredibly a smoking room.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. So you could puff on cigars, cigarettes, pipes, while riding in something that was kept aloft by 5 million cubic feet of hydrogen. 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 The room was pressurized so that hydrogen could not enter it. Even still, the lighters provided were electric, as they didn't want to risk open flame on account of they were actually flying a pretty silver floating bomb filled with highly freaking flammable hydrogen. Hydrogen. Not helium, the way that blimps are flown now. Hydrogen. Which will explode. Spoiler alert. So the Hindenburg's operators were experimenting with a very cool feature. So they rigged up a trapeze-like aircraft hook point. The idea was that as they approached their destination, custom officials would fly out to them, board and process the passengers in the air so the passengers wouldn't have to wait to do it on the ground.
Oh.
So like customs would come up into the blimp do customs, and then you get to like disembark.
Huh. Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So interesting. So two experiments with the new aircraft hookup in March and April of 1937 ran into problems with turbulence. Then before they had a chance to iron those kinks out, some shit went down in May. So after opening its 1937 season by completing a single round trip passage to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil in late March, the Hindenburg departed from Frankfurt, Germany on the evening of May 3rd on the first of 10 round trips between Europe and the United States that were scheduled for its second year of commercial service. Still new.
So what year is this?
1937.
Okay.
American Airlines had contracted with the operators of the Hindenburg to shuttle the passengers from Lakehurst to Newark for connections to airplane flights. So it came from Germany to New Jersey and was going to like do a couple really quick trips as like a connecting flight.
Uh-huh.
Except for strong headwinds that slowed its progress, the Atlantic crossing of the Hindenburg was otherwise unremarkable until the airship attempted an early evening landing at Lakehurst 3 days later on May 6th. Although carrying only half of its full capacity of passengers, 36 out of 70, and crewmen, 61, 21 of which were trainees.
That is two crewsmen?
61 total, and 21 of them were trainees. So it was carrying 36 passengers.
Yeah, but that's two crew people per passenger.
Yes. That's well, you have to think, like, you have the flying, the kitchen, the janitorial. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Still a lot.
It is a lot. The Hindenburg was fully booked for its return flight because many of the passengers would take us to Germany were planning to attend the coronation of King George the VI and Queen Elizabeth in London the following week.
Okay.
The airship was hours behind schedule when it passed over Boston on the morning of May 6th, and its landing at Lakehurst was expected to be further delayed because of afternoon thunderstorms. Advised of the poor weather conditions at Lakehurst, Captain Max Pruss charted a course over Manhattan Island, causing a public spectacle as people rushed out into the street to catch sight of the airship. After passing over the field at 4 p.m., Captain Pruss took passengers on a tour over the seasides of New Jersey while waiting for the weather to clear. After finally being notified at 6:22 p.m. that the storms had passed, Pruss directed the airship back to Lakehurst to make its landing almost half a day late. However, as this would leave much less time than anticipated to service and prepare the airship for its scheduled departure back to Europe, the public was informed that they would not be permitted at the mooring location or be able to visit aboard the Hindenburg during its stay in port. So they're like, we're doing a quick turnaround.
All right.
So, I'm about to break down a pretty detailed timeline, which are all very important details that will make sense at a later date.
You know how I love a detail.
I know, and I'm about to give it to you. So, timeline of the disaster. Around 7 p.m. local time at an altitude of 650 feet, the Hindenburg made its final approach to the Lakehurst Naval Air Station. This was to be a high landing known as a flying moor because the airship would drop its landing ropes and mooring cables at a high altitude and then be winched down to the mooring mast. So it would drop ropes and they would attach it up and then they would just like crank it down.
All right.
Okay. This type of landing maneuver would reduce the number of ground crewmen but would require more time. Although the high landing was a common procedure for American airships, the Hindenburg had only performed this maneuver a few times in 1936 while landing in Lakehurst. At 7:09, the airship made a sharp, full-speed left turn to the west around the landing field because a ground crew was not ready. At 7:11, it turned back towards the landing field and valved gas. All engines idled ahead, and the airship began to slow, so it dropped gas to like try to chill it out a little bit.
Okay.
Captain Pruss ordered aft engines full astern at 7:14 while at an altitude of 394 feet to try to brake the airship. At 7:17, the wind shifted direction from east to southwest, and Captain Pruss ordered a second sharp turn starboard, making an S-shaped flight path down the mooring mast. At 7:18, as the final turn progressed, Pruss ordered 300 and 300 and then 500 pounds of water dropped because the airship was like stern heavy. So it was like a little lopsided. So
this is not the same as all of these earlier like super smooth trips.
Because a thunderstorm had just left. And so the wind is super like unpredictable right now.
As you would say, they are unstable.
A little unsteady. The forward gas cells were also valved. So it is dropping water and it is dropping gasoline. Trying to like balance it out. It's like a hot air balloon. Where like you don't have control over the wind and you don't have like any real propellers. So you're just trying to drop stuff to like make it steady.
Oh, okay.
These measures failed to bring the ship in trim. So, 6 men, 3 of whom were killed in the accident, were sent to the bow to trim the airship to try to balance it out.
So, like, their weight was what was going to go help it out?
They're trying anything. They were sent elsewhere in the ship to do further, like, attempts things to balance out the ship.
Okay.
At 7:21, while the Hindenburg was at an altitude of 295 feet, so we're dropping a little bit, the mooring lines were dropped from the bow, and the starboard line was dropped first, followed by the port line. The port line was over-tightened as it was connected to the post of the ground winch, and the starboard line had still not been connected.
Oh, no.
Right. At this time, a light rain began to fall as the ground crew grabbed the mooring lines.
Of course it did.
At 7:25 p.m., a few witnesses saw the fabric ahead of the upper fin flutter as if gas were leaking. Others reported seeing a dim blue flame, possibly static electricity or St. Elmo's fire, moments before the fire on top and in the back of the ship near the point where the flames first appeared. Several other eyewitness testimonies suggest that the first flame appeared on the port side just ahead of the port fin and was followed by flames which burned on top. Commander Rosendahl testified to the flames in front of the upper fin being mushroom-shaped. One witness on the starboard side reported a fire beginning lower and behind the rudder on that side. On board, people heard a muffled detonation, and those in the front of the ship felt a shock as the port trail rope over-tightened. The officers in the control car initially thought the shock was caused by a broken rope. At 7:25 p.m. local time, the Hindenburg caught fire and quickly became engulfed in flames. Eyewitness statements disagreed as to where the fire initially broke out. Several witnesses on the port side saw yellow-red flames first jump forward on the top fin near the ventilation shaft. Other witnesses on the other side noted that the fire actually began just ahead of the front fin, only then followed by flames in the front of the top fin. With views of the starboard side, saw flames beginning lower and farther aft. So there were cameras that recorded this.
Okay.
And of all of the cameras, they all missed when the fire started.
Wow. That's like all the things that make a disaster. It's things like that, the footage that's missing, or all of these things that of course it's missing.
Yes. And there's so many photographs and film of this disaster. None of it is when it started. So wherever they started, the flames quickly spread towards first consuming cells 1 through 9 at the rear end of the structure, exploded.
Oh,
almost
my God.
Instantly, two tanks burst out of the hull as a result of the shock of the blast. Buoyancy was lost on the stern of the ship and the bow lurched upwards while the ship's back broke. The following stern stayed in trim, so it stayed flat. As the tail of the Hindenburg crashed to the ground, a burst of flame came out of the nose, killing 9 of the 12 crew members in the bow. There was still gas in the bow section of the ship, so it continued to point upwards as the stern collapsed down. The cell behind the passenger decks ignited as the side collapsed inward, and the scarlet lettering reading Hindenburg was erased by flames as the bow descended. The airship's gondola wheel touched the ground, causing the bow to bounce up slightly as one final gas cell burned away. At this point, most of the fabric on the hull had also burned away, and the bow finally crashed to the ground.
Wow.
Although the hydrogen had finished burning, the Hindenburg's diesel fuel burned for several more hours. The time that it took from the first signs of disaster to the bow crashing to the ground is reported as either 32, 34, or 37 seconds.
Oh my God.
Seconds. It was filled with hydrogen.
It was just like,
it happened in a split second, that it was fine. They saw a flame and it was burnt.
And it was not fine.
And it was not fine. And there was seriously nothing left except the shell of the ship.
Oh my God.
Since none of the newsreel cameras were filming the airship, when the fire started, the time of the start can only be estimated from various eyewitness accounts and the duration of the longest footage of the crash. One careful analysis by Addison Bain, who works for freaking NASA.
Oh, yeah.
Gives the flames front spread rate across the fabric skin as about 49 feet per second at some points during the crash, which would have resulted in a total destruction time of 16 seconds.
Oh, that's not long. Not a lot of things can happen in 16 seconds.
But about...
I could probably pour myself another glass of wine in 16 seconds.
I could drink that glass of wine in 16 seconds, and an entire airship would be gone.
That... I cannot compute.
Mm-mm. 13 of the 36 passengers died.
Oh my gosh.
And 22 of the 61 crew died. Aww. Most survivors were severely burned. Also killed was one ground crewman, the civilian linesman Alan Hageman. Of the deaths, 10 passengers and 16 crewmen died in the crash or in the fire because majority of the victims burnt to death.
Oh my gosh.
While the rest died jumping from the airship at an excessive height. 6 other crew members, 3 passengers, and Alan Hageman died in the following hours of days as a consequence of the burns they sustained. In the days after the disaster, an official board of inquiry was set up at Lakehurst to investigate the cause of the fire. The investigation of the U.S. Commerce Department was headed by Colonel South Trimble Jr., while Dr. Hugo Eckner led the German commission. So I'm about to bridge so quickly into conspiracy.
Ooh.
Because the things that they thought causes, it happened so quick. Nobody had film. They didn't. No.
Aliens.
Aliens. They didn't. Oh, there's acrobats. There's all. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So Hugo Eckner, former head of the Zeppelin company and the old man of German airships, was on a lecture tour in Austria at the time of the disaster.
Uh-huh.
He was awoken at about 2:30 in the morning, which was 8:30 p.m. Lakehurst time, about an hour after the crash, by the ringing of his bedside telephone. It was a Berlin representative of the New York Times with news that the Hindenburg exploded above the airfield at Lakehurst. Can you imagine being woken up out of a dead sleep?
With by such terrible news.
Right, by some, like, 18-year-old journalist that was like, "Sir, your ship exploded. What do you have to say?" That's how he found out that it happened.
As people who have experienced getting really terrible news, I'm very grateful that nobody expected me to have a statement prepared.
Nay. But poor boy was forced to make a statement.
And this is why in every good emergency binder, there is a pre-written statement for you to give to the media.
Please contact our marketing department for a statement regarding the event that you are questioning. That's ours. So by the time he left the hotel the next morning to travel to Berlin for a briefing on the disaster, the only answer he had for reporters, because he did not have an emergency preparedness binder, was that sabotage was why.
Sabotage.
It was sabotage, I tell you. It was. It wasn't me. The Germans in the late 1930s wasn't us.
Canary, see?
Sabotage. Another proponent of the sabotage hypothesis was Max Press, the commander of the Hindenburg throughout the airship's career. He flew on nearly every single freaking flight from the Graf Zeppelin until the Hindenburg was ready, and on a 1960 interview conducted with Kenneth Leach for Columbia University Orals History Research Office, Press said early dirigible travel was safe, and therefore he strongly believed that sabotage was to blame. He stated that on trips to South America, which was a popular destination for German tourists, both airships passed through thunderstorms and were struck by lightning, but remained unharmed. Most members of the crew refused to believe that one of them would commit an act of sabotage, insisting only a passenger could have destroyed the airship. A suspect favored by Commander Rosendahl, Captain Press, and others among the Hindenburg's crew was passenger Joseph Spee, a German acrobat who survived the fire.
Acrobat? Okay.
He brought with him a dog, a German shepherd named Ulla, as a surprise for his children.
Oh, baby.
I know.
Did the puppy make it?
He reportedly made a number of unaccompanied visits to feed his dog, who was being kept in a freight room near the stern of the ship. Those who suspected Spee based their suspicions primarily on those trips into the ship's interior to feed the dog. That, according to some of the stewards, Spee had told anti-Nazi jokes during the flight. Problematic, but like, not him. Always tell anti-Nazi jokes.
Yeah, I was like, wait a second.
But, like, the Nazi party was still in, like, its preliminary, like, World War II had not started yet.
Right. Okay. So, okay.
Mm-hmm.
This poor acrobat.
Right. Recollections by stewards that he told anti-Nazi jokes. He seemed agitated by the repeated delays in landing and that he was an acrobat, quote, who could conceivably climb into the airship's rigging to plant a bomb.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. In 1962, A.A. Holing published Who Destroyed the Hindenburg, in which he rejected all theories but sabotage and named a crew member as a suspect, Eric Spiel. A rigger on the Hindenburg who died in the fire was named as a saboteur. 10 years later, Michael McDonald Mooney's book, The Hindenburg, which was based heavily on Holing's sabotage hypothesis, also identified him as a saboteur. And this is what he claimed in naming him as the culprit. His girlfriend had communist beliefs and anti-Nazi connections. The fire's origin was near the catwalk running through gas cell 4, which was an area of the ship generally off limits to anyone other than Spiel and his fellow riggers. Holling's claim that Chief Steward Heinrich Kubis told him that Chief Rigger Ludwig Nohr noticed damage of cell 4 shortly before the disaster. Rumors that the Gestapo had investigated Spiel's possible involvement in 1938. Spiel's interest in amateur photography, making him familiar with flash bulbs that could have served as an igniter.
Oh my gosh.
The discovery by representatives of the New York Police Department bomb squad of a substance that was later determined to likely be the insoluble residue from the depolarizing element of a small dry battery. Saying that a dry cell battery at the time powered flash bulbs and was used as an incendiary device. The discovery by the FBI agents of a yellow substance on the valve cap of the airship between cells 4 and 5 where the fire was first reported. Although initially suspected to be sulfur, which can ignite hydrogen, it was later determined that the residue was actually from a freaking fire extinguisher. A flash or bright reflection in gas cell 4 that crew members near the lower fin had seen just before the fire. So, the hypothesis goes on to say that it's unlikely that Spiel wanted to kill people and that he intended the airship to burn after the landing. However, the ship already over 12 hours late, Spiel was unable to find an excuse to reset the timer on his bomb. It has been suggested that Adolf Hitler himself ordered the Hindenburg to be destroyed in retaliation for Eichner's anti-Nazi operations. In more scientific and also realistic arguments, it is argued that the fire was started by an electric spark, which was caused by a buildup of static electricity on the airship. The spark ignited hydrogen on the outer skin. So there's 1,010 hypotheses about what the hell actually happened. Lightning, fuel leak, acrobats, Nazis, and so many vital details died with the crew and passengers, and the initial fire wasn't caught on camera, so we will never know.
Wow.
What caused this to happen. What we do know is that it halted the forward movement of the rigid shell airship business. Like, it was done.
We have a helicopter or a plane, I think.
The window is open because my AC doesn't work and it was like an ungodly 70 degrees today.
Well, anyways,
that is not the Hindenburg. That is not like special effect
sounds. There we go.
I like it.
I was like, what is happening?
You really got into the story, didn't you?
Secondhand PTSD. Sorry.
So it halted the airship business altogether. It was never, ever after this. It was devastating to the people.
Just like, they all woke up the next day and didn't have jobs anymore.
Everybody woke up and they're like, oh, well, we're not doing that again. And it stopped an entire industry that was just getting born, which I think would be so cool today.
Absolutely. I would love some of that, like, old-fashioned travel. Like, I would love to go by train somewhere.
I would also love and to, like, go by train, not Amtrak.
No. I want to be in, a sleeper car.
Yep.
In a train, take me to Harry Potter, take me to Hogwarts, mm-hmm. Let's go. In a blimp, that would be so fun.
No, that's what this was, a blimp.
Without the...
Hydrogen. Helium instead.
Let's make it fireproof, please.
Uh-huh.
Make it fireproof. That's the name of this episode.
This, but make it fireproof. It changed the course of history on an intercontinental travel. And it gave us a really famous line that has been regurgitated in history of, oh, the humanity. So there is a recording that is appalling to listen to. And I have the clip of it saved.
That was very dramatic stacking. Sorry. Of you.
I have the clip of it saved. If I'm smart and Taylor is smarter than me, so if she can figure out a way to input this clip into the podcast.
You already have it saved.
I have it saved.
Okay, that makes my job easier.
Okay. It is a gentleman who is recording, like reporting live from the landing of the Hindenburg.
Ooh.
And there is a gentleman named Charlie who was filming. And it is him panicking. And he is the one that says, oh, the humanity. And we will input it here.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, we'll put it here.
It's starting to rain again. The rain has slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It's rushing to flash. Get it started. Get it started. It's flashing. And it's flashing. It's flashing. Terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast. And all the folks between that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's flashing. 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around here. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people. There's friends around there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just laying there a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
So, appalling, awful, terrifying. It was world-changing, and honestly, it's a disaster that's kind of been lost to time.
Yeah, like, we don't normally give each other too much of a heads up, but over dinner, we were just talking about kind of what we were doing, and you said the Hindenburg, and I said, I don't know what that is. And then you gave me, like, a little bit of a clip it, and I thought I had heard the story before, but I don't... I definitely hadn't heard the whole story.
It kind of got, you know, like overshadowed by a little thing called World War II.
Weird.
Weird. And it was, it changed the course of history. And I think it's crazy that not a lot of people know about it. So now you do.
Wow. Thanks for that history lesson / disaster.
You're so welcome. Thanks for hanging in there. I know it got like a little detail heavy there, but.
I like it.
I'm glad.
Would you be so kind as to pour me another glass of wine while I get my story ready? I am ready.
Okay. We're back. Donut had to enter the room.
We had to take a little potty break. We had to get a wine refill. We're good. We're ready to go. I am remembering that I forgot to tell you my sources on our mashup episode. Oh. So I'm going to start with those because okay. I do not trust myself to tell you to them at the end. We have Bad Day HQ on YouTube.
Okay.
NBC Connecticut.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Connecticut.
Gabulosa.
Ooh.
On YouTube.
Okay.
And Calamity Podcast.
Oh, that sounds like a fun one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you the story of the Hartford Circus Fire of 1944.
Hartford, Connecticut.
Connecticut. So we did the thing where we tell a similar story on accident. So there's a lot of parallels here.
Okay.
Basically fires that shouldn't have happened.
Stop making things so freaking flammable.
Oh, on purpose. Hey,
Donut.
Stay away from my keyboard. You pause things and you don't mean to do it. Hi, baby.
Come over here. Hey, you're big and floofy.
Come on. Oh my gosh, Jo today came and just like literally flopped herself down on my keyboard. It was the cutest thing alive. Excuse you, do not play this.
Come here.
Trying to sass me.
Why are you trying to do the nim-noms on your friend Tater Tot?
She thinks she my friend, but she steal my mom attention for too long.
Him lost weight and I can see his neck and I'm concerned. I'm going to take him to a vet.
Happy Cat is losing weight.
Is he?
Yeah, I think it's because Jo just runs him around all the time, but he is definitely a lot skinnier.
You smell like an old washcloth.
He a little mildowy?
A little mildowy. You mildonut boy.
Okay. Mildo is the new name.
Ew, it sounds like dildo.
Dildo. Never mind. Scratch it.
Okay. Tell me about this flammable.
I would love to. As we like to do, let's set the scene. It is hot AF because it's July.
Ew.
In 1944.
Ooh.
World War II is still going strong, and people need a good, solid distraction from the reality of everyday life. And the best form of a distraction is a circus.
Isn't it always?
Always. So the circus was one of the 40s best, most family-friendly forms of entertainment. So everybody went. It was something that people put on their calendars and counted down the day until the circus arrived in town. It was a big deal.
Really?
Big deal.
Okay. I've never been to the circus. I gotta be honest.
I went when I was in school, like in middle school, and that was great. It was a fun time, and that was my only memory of the circus. And then I dragged Ryan when we had just first started dating, and he was like, I do not want to go to the circus. And I was like, you hate fun, and we're going. And we went, and the lady at the box office convinced me to buy the floor seat tickets. So I did.
Okay.
And it was very sad.
Oh, animals.
Yeah. I mean, we left and I was just like a shell of my former self.
God, I'm sorry. It's not funny.
It was very sad. It
really sucked the joy out of circuses.
Right. And Ryan, it was like, I tried to tell you we shouldn't go. And I was like, no, you did not tell me why you didn't want to go. You just said you didn't want to go.
You're just like, meh, circus. I don't want to go.
Yeah. No, we would have said animal abuse, I wouldn't have gone.
Sold.
Damn.
See how simple communication is.
Right. He's come a long way.
Yeah.
Okay, so short history of the circus. The Ringling Brothers Circus was originally made up of the seven Ringling Brothers, who were performers. Before their start of their circus, the brothers had a small touring routine with juggling and skits, and they formed their official circus in 1882.
So you're not going to tell me anything that I don't know about the Ringling Brothers?
Okay.
Because there is a museum in Sarasota, Florida.
Yeah.
That I have been to many times when I lived in Florida.
Fantastic. That's my only fact about Ringling Brothers.
Oh, okay.
That's it.
They have a really beautiful estate that they bought right on the Gulf of Mexico. There's a giant mansion that you can go walk through that has all the original furniture. And it's like that early, like turn of the century, like splendor that's like built like French Versailles style. Ooh. There's a set of stairs that descend directly into the Gulf of Mexico. Mrs. Ringling had an amazing art museum.
Like Mama Ringling?
Mama Ringling.
Aww.
Had an amazing art museum that is still there.
Can we go?
Fuck yeah.
I want to go.
I have a pass.
Shut up.
Swear, I went there like maybe 10 times.
You're like a frequent flyer.
Yes, and you can just go in, and I would go because there's a really beautiful mangrove there, and she also had rose gardens. And she has exotic roses that still grow there today.
Stop!
And you can just go and walk through the rose gardens. It is beautiful, old Florida. Problematic because it's the circus, but they have like some of the original train cars that you can go walk through. It's amazing.
Right.
So, go on.
Oh, I want to go. And yeah, problematic because the circus
is not great.
And I will preface this. It is a disaster, so we know that there's about to be death and destruction. No animals were harmed in my disaster.
Thank God.
I can't handle it. So. No.
We don't do animal deaths here. So much sadder than human death. Yeah.
Human death, we got that all day long. We got it in spades.
Yeah.
Animal death, it is going to take something very serious for me to do an animal death. I actually have one in my head that I know I'm going to do.
An animal death?
It's an I can't decide if it's true crime or disaster. I will do it. But animals are harmed in the telling of this story, although this is a very... I don't want to give too much away.
Okay. You just sit on it. Do it the next true crime or disaster.
I'm obsessed with this story.
Really?
I obsessed. Obsessed. Okay.
Okay.
Anywho, next up we have Barnum and Bailey's.
Eek.
And, you know, P.T. Barnum, thanks to The Greatest Showman.
Oh, God.
thanks, Hugh Jackman. Holla. Oh, he brings us so many good things. He brought us Van Helsing.
Wow. Sorry. That sounded so much less authentic than how I meant.
Just snorted.
Wow. I was thinking like Miz for him, but yes. Also, Van Helsing.
Wow.
Wow. What is he when he's fingernail stabby boy? What series is
Wolverine.
That? Yes, that one.
X-Men?
Yeah.
I do love him as X-Men, let's be real.
Do you? I haven't seen any of them. I know.
Okay. Before I met my comic book nerd husband, I loved the X-Men.
Really?
Yeah. Like, early high school loved the X-Men.
Okay.
But he's in the X-Men. Okay. Barnum and Bailey was formed by P.T. Barnum and James Anthony Bailey in 1871, and the Ringling Brothers purchased Barnum and Bailey Limited following Bailey's death in 1906, but the circuses ran separately until they were merged in 1919.
Okay.
So our story is going to technically start on July 5th of 1944. In circus world, being delayed and late is viewed as a bad omen, and there are a lot of superstitious beliefs around any delays. So when the circus arrived late in Connecticut on July 5th and had to cancel one of the two shows that day, all performers were on edge. There were some shortcuts taken that would prove to be disastrous. These shortcuts included the performers leaving the fire extinguishers in their cases instead of setting them up in their designated spots. So, the big top tent was big. Big.
How big was she?
Let me tell you. It was nearly 525 feet long, which I did the math, and that is about 1.5 football fields.
Holy mackerel. Listen, we have to measure in football fields because we are in marching band, and that's the only thing we know.
I know exactly how long my stride is in comparison to a football field. That's the only thing I know.
Okay.
So that is about 160 meters. It was 213 feet wide, which is 65 meters.
Wow.
And 164 feet tall, which is 50 meters. So,
wow.
It's big.
That's a big fatty tank.
I know. In my head, that was not an accurate number.
I saw Water for Elephants, and that tent was not that big.
No.
I also saw Freak Show. And that was not that big.
I also saw Freak Show. there were 9 exits.
Wow. Okay.
However,
oh.
2 of them were blocked by animal tunnels, which were big fenced in like chutes for the animals to come in and out
of. So bears can't crawl around?
Exactly.
Smart.
5 were used by performers, and so no one really knew where they were. It's just they weren't like well marked. They weren't used for...
You just file in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there were 2 exits that people knew about.
Ooh.
The tent could hold 9,000 people.
What? Are you sure?
Uh-huh.
That doesn't seem like enough. That seems like a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
9,000 people in the bleachers and chairs that were on the lawn. The chairs were like the best seats. They were the floor seats.
Okay.
The specific big top tent was brand new and needed to be waterproofed. Oh, poor Donut needs to be let out. He can't take it. Can't take the captivity. The captivity.
Cat. Paranormal captivity.
Okay. The tent needed to be waterproofed. Not fireproofed. Waterproofed.
Oh, we're very concerned about rain.
Yes, very concerned about rain. So the waterproofing material, the good kind, was going toward the war effort because we're in the middle of the war. So they had to use a little bit of a makeshift DIY waterproofing agent.
Yikes.
Which was 2/3 paraffin wax and 1/3 gasoline.
What?
Which they would mix together in big old fatty buckets.
No.
And with a mop.
No.
Spread on top of the big top tent.
Is this the best we got?
Yes.
You just made fuel. You.
Yeah, and put it on canvas.
Waxed gasoline.
Put it on canvas.
Okay, cool.
Water droplets just gonna roll right off.
Congratulations, you made a tinderbox.
Yes.
Okay.
And although they had to cancel one of the shows on the 5th, the other show went on without a hitch. And the shows that were scheduled for the 6th were getting ready to start. The 6th is a Thursday.
Okay.
In case anybody wants to know.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The calendar.
A crowd at the afternoon performance was the crowd. Sorry, I'm going to start over. The crowd at the afternoon performance was dominated by women and children because all of the men were gone for the war.
Doing war effort things.
Yes. The size of the audience that day has never been fully established with any certainty, but the best estimate is about 1,000 people. And we'll talk about the audience kind of again later, but I want to bring it up now that back then, there was a lot of just kind of meandering around. So there were a lot of people who were just transients and passing through. And there were also a lot of free tickets given out that day just to get people to fill seats.
Oh, because they didn't want, like, if you imagine 1,000 people in a 9,000 person, quote unquote, stadium.
Right. It looks empty.
Yeah. And that's not what you want.
Right.
It's like the fucking Trump rally.
Yeah. So there were definitely a lot of people there that weren't really accounted for.
Sure.
But still, women and children definitely were the audience primary. That day.
Yeah.
The show on the 6th started on time, and after the Lion Act, the flying Wallendas, high wire act was getting ready to perform. At 2:23, people noticed a small flame near the southwest entrance of the tent, and it was about the size of a window.
Okay.
So not huge in comparison to the, like, whole tent, but still enough to cause a little bit of distress.
I hate to, like, be a real nitpicker about fire safety,
uh-huh.
but, like, any fire is too much fire.
Yeah. It's not good.
Put it out. We're right. just going to sit there and be like,
no big.
Yeah, it's fine. Just a window-sized fire.
Right. Well, I think the point of it being like a window-sized fire is that in comparison to the tent, it didn't really look that big to a lot of people. And there were so many workers there that most people just thought they'll put it out.
Them. Yeah.
No big deal.
Or maybe they thought it was like part of the act.
Right.
Okay.
It just didn't seem like that big of a deal.
Okay.
Merle Evans, who is the band director, was one of the first to spot the flames, and he directed the band to play the Stars and Stripes Forever, which is a signal to all performers that something was happening. It was like their bat signal.
Ew, I love that. I know, they have that.
I was like, this is amazing. Of course the band has that. Nerds. The Wallendas abandoned their act, and that was the first thing that tipped off the crowd that something was wrong.
Okay.
Ushers grabbed buckets of water to put out the flames, but it had no effect.
Ooh.
And remember, fire extinguishers were just chilling in their traveling boxes because nobody put them out. Fred Bradna was the ringleader, and he was announcing to the crowd to stay calm and that they would get things under control taken care of quickly. But the fire was near the generator, and the power went out. And so nobody could hear him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the fire just exploded. It grew so fast.
Oh, God.
One survivor named Donald Glover, and there are three Donalds in our stand. Three Donalds in our story. Okay.
Childish Gambino. Okay, yeah. Sorry. Go on. His name is also Donald Glover, and is like the third.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Donald Glover said that it was like a tornado was behind it and pushing it and swirling it around.
Ooh.
Most people stood and started to try to get down the bleachers to reach the ground, and some were just sitting in their seats, like, staring at all these people panicking, like, oh my God, these people, like, panicking so easily. Like, they're going to get it under control, and I don't want to lose my seat.
Wow.
When they get it under control.
Imagine being that horny for a circus.
No kidding. So the nice seats were the chairs that were on the ground level, and when people started pushing and shoving, the chairs started getting tossed around and ended up creating an additional obstacle.
And also, tinder.
More things to burn.
Great.
It did not need more.
Nay.
The ushers were telling all 7,000 people to exit through the entrance.
What? No. That's too many people in one little space. Mm-hmm.
Some people were able to get through the performer's exit on the southern side of the tent. There is a very heartbreaking photo that we'll post. And it is a famous clown named Emmett Kelly who tried to help people through. And you know, everybody, I am also one that has like a tiny fear of clowns, but not paralyzing.
I don't like clowns.
What?
I don't like clowns.
It's a very common fear.
Yeah.
And everyone who talked about Emmett Kelly, this is like the original what a clown was supposed to be. He was there for entertainment, and he loved entertaining children. Aww. And children were his life. That was the only thing he wanted to do, was make children laugh.
I don't trust anybody who's like, it's not the clowns that I'm scared of. I'm scared of the people who dress up as clowns.
Like, that's because we know about John Wayne Gacy.
That's true. That's true.
So if we take John Wayne out of the picture and we just leave Emmett Kelly, we have an actual wholesome human here. And he was forever changed and traumatized by this day. Mm. He was never the same. And there's a photo of him in all of his clown regalia carrying buckets of water to try to help put out the fire. And we'll post that photo. But it's heart-wrenching because he has like sad clown makeup on, but you can also see that he's crying.
Oh, ow.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
It's very emotional.
I'm having clown flashbacks to a Mother's Day party in Indiana State Women's Prison that I attended at like 13 years old.
Yeah.
And there were clowns there. And I was like, what do you do in like your regular waking hours that you're spending your weekend dressed as a clown at the state women's prison?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mom was very afraid of clowns. Super not chill on clowns. And I think because she was so over the top in almost everything that she did, including her like fear of clowns, that as a child I just thought it was really funny that she was that afraid of them. And so I think that's just carried over to my normal life. I don't want to be alone.
With a clown in an alley?
Probably not.
No. Mm-hmm.
Also, clowns don't belong after dark.
No.
After dark clowns, that's what you gotta worry about. Daylight clowns, less scary.
Okay.
Anyway, Donald Gale, Donald number two, was at the circus that day with his mother's best friend named Helga and her boyfriend and her daughter.
Mm.
And she had gotten trapped, and he had gotten trapped in the chairs, and she was trying to help him. So he was under all of these stacked up chairs.
No.
She was trying to like throw these chairs off of him when a panicked soldier came barreling through and knocked her over. Gale believed she hit her head and was knocked unconscious, but when he was able to get up, there was so much rushing around and smoke, he couldn't find her, and someone grabbed him and took him outside. So he lost track of Helga.
Oh no.
And he was a child. I mean, he was like 9.
Oh.
So there's another man named Bill Curley, and he was one of the very few able-bodied men in the circus that day. And he was just an audience member. He was with a group of people who were trying to get out, but were blocked by one of the animal tunnels that were the metal fences that were shaped like tunnels.
Sure.
And he got up and over it, straddled it on top, and people were just handing him children. And he was, like, tossing children over to the other side so that they could get out. And he probably saved, I think it's, like, over 100 children that
day. Oh, my God.
Just bless him.
Ew, that gave me chills.
So once the canvas burned, and this was something that I didn't even think about, the whole canvas fell in.
Oh.
And the paraffin wax was on fire and melting and falling onto people.
Oh.
So it was, not only is the whole tent on fire, it's also
dripping.
Dripping hot burning wax. Horrible. And the whole thing came crashing down, and from the start of the fire to when the tent came crashing down, it was only 8 minutes.
That is, he saved like 100 kids in 8 minutes?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Just like chucking them.
Sorry, that's not funny, but I'm just thinking like catapulting kids over like a 10-foot fence.
Yeah. Yeah, and there were people on the ground catching that, but he was just like, whoosh, hoping that like his buddy on the ground is going to help him out, because die burning.
Like, get him out.
Get up a broken ankle or die. You can get a
broken elbow, you're going to be fine.
You're going to be fine. Once the canvas burned and the poles and ropes gave out, like I said, there was only 8 minutes between when that happened and when the canvas fell. Elliot Smith and Donald Gale were found under two different piles of bodies when the firefighters finally arrived. And the firefighters didn't get there until well after the canvas had fell down. God. So there were people who were found underneath piles of bodies.
Alive?
Alive, and the bodies is what helped protect them against the fire.
The smell.
Yes. So Elliot is interviewed in a short documentary I watched, and he said something heartbreaking, and because I had to hear it, you now also have to hear it.
Oh, great.
You're welcome. He said, "I could hear people screaming and praying, and then the screaming stopped, and then the crying stopped, and I passed out."
Oh.
Most of the dead were found at either of the two runways on the north side. Donald Anderson was a kid at the time of the fire, probably 12 years old or so, and he had a huge, large pocket knife on him, and he was a quick thinker and just cut through canvas.
Smart kid.
Like, create my own exit.
He's like, I got it.
Right, but people weren't thinking that way.
Well, no, you panic.
Right, and you just follow the crowd.
Yeah.
So he, this 12-year-old, was like, bruh, it's just canvas.
Cut through it.
So he ended up saving about 300 people that way by cutting holes in the canvas.
Smart man.
He was given an award for his bravery, and he was in this documentary I watched, and he just doesn't like to talk about it. He'll talk about the experience, but he doesn't like to talk about how
the actual,
what he did saved people's lives. He's very humble like that, and he says that others would have done the same. All told, about 168 people died, and they were mostly women and children. 700 people were treated for their injuries. Bill Curley died saving hundreds of children. So he was found on top of the animal tunnel. Helga was also found among the dead. Elliot's mother had terrible burns and had to wear a wig for the rest of her life because a huge glob of the paraffin wax fell on top of her. Elliot himself was in the hospital for 5 months for burns.
Wow.
Yep. And he shared a room with Donald Gale, who also underwent surgeries for burns, and his head and arms were damaged and his fingers were fused together.
Oh.
And Donald was in the hospital for 6 months. The circus fire fighting methods were never put into place. Aside from the extinguishers not being put out, there were supposed to be fire trucks that were paid by the circus, like, waiting on standby, and they weren't there.
Where were they?
I don't know.
Did the circus not pay, or?
No, I think they were circus workers. Like, I think that they were a part of the circus, like, that traveled with them.
And they just weren't there.
Right, they just weren't there. Or it could have been that the circus workers set up trucks and then went and did their own like thing, but they didn't go, they didn't set up the traps.
Do they know what caused the fire?
I will get to that.
Okay, sorry.
No, you're good. A year after the fire, six men were charged with involuntary manslaughter. The general manager and chief tentman were both sentenced to 7 years. The vice president got 1 to 5 years, and the other three got 6 months. However, no one served more than a year because eventually they were all pardoned.
God.
One of the men, James A. Haley, went on to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives for 24 years.
Oh, great.
I love that.
Mm.
The circus was fined $10,000, and that's in 1944 money. The circus accepted all financial responsibility for the fire. In addition to the fire, the circus reached an agreement with Hartford officials to accept full responsibility there as well and pay whatever amount the city requested in damages. This resulted in the circus paying almost $5 million.
In what money?
In then money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I did not do the math because that was a large enough number.
$5 million? And what is this, 1944?
Yeah.
Okay, hold. Nee, 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 nee,
nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee, nee. We're so annoying.
I know. Holy mother fluffin' gosh.
How many? How many dollars?
Okay, well, 1 million. Okay, hold on, let me just
Oh, we got to do the calculator.
It required me to multiply in my head, and I could not do that.
You've had a long day of numbers.
I've had a long day of numbers. Whoa! $73.8 million.
That was the wrong time for me to take a swig of my wine.
Wah!
$73.8
million.
Million.
In 2020 money dollars.
And that was paid to the victims and families who filed claims against the circus by 1954, which was a total of 600 people.
Okay.
So, I mean, 73.8 divided by 600 is still quite a bit of money per family.
Hold on, I will do that math for you right now.
I appreciate that. And we have our plane is back.
It's the Hindenburg. That, oh. 6,600 people.
600.
It's $130,000 per person.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it would be more.
It's not. Seems like it would be.
Should be.
But, like, when you take into account, like, medical bills and loss of life.
If funerals be expensive, y'all.
I mean, that's, like, life insurance policies. And plus, I'm sure those families also... Was life insurance a thing in 1944?
Yeah.
Okay,
because you could buy life insurance on another person without their knowledge in 1944.
Hence... Murder.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And that's when murder was born.
The origin story.
Forget the Bible. 1944.
Oh, God. Okay. All circus profits from the time of the fire until then had been set aside to pay these claims. Which, from a business aspect, intelligent move.
Smart move.
They were just like, we are not going to cash out on any of this because we know that this is coming.
Correct. And that was very smart. Did they pay their people still?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. That was 1954. So 10 years later, they knew that this was coming.
Who knew that the circus business was so freaking lucrative? And imagine the overhead. Now, listen, I'm in like business mode because I have been working
on a budget for like, the last
on a budget all
10 hours of the last 10 months of your life.
Yes. But the overhead for like upkeep, let's just talk about animals. Upkeep of the animals, purchasing of the animals, veterinary, food, the people who care for the animals.
Steaks a lion eats a day?
Can you? Well, I'm sure they're not feeding it. It's like some kind of like Joe Exotic. They're feeding it old baloney.
Right. They're chucking over deer.
Yeah. But like they own a train, upkeep on the train, the overhead cost for like management,
mm-hmm.
buying a new canvas covered in hydrogen.
whatever. Covered in hydrogen.
Whatever it was. Like, that's insane that yeah. they were able to set aside $73 million in yeah. 10 years to pay reparations.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
I was not... I was very saddened that this happened. And I wouldn't have been surprised if my research had led me down a different path that said something along the lines of, like, the family never saw a penny.
Right. And the circus was like, well, sorry. And then they were like, that sucks. Stayed away.
Yeah. But, I mean, really nothing in my research led me down that path. It was all like, yeah, they took responsibility for it. They do not accept responsibility for the start of the fire. They don't say that that was their fault, but okay. They do accept the responsibility of paying out the families. And
who were there.
Yeah. The circus, yada yada, accepted responsibility. Some reports say that a tossed cigarette was the cause of the blaze.
Ooh.
Yeah. And others point to arson.
Ooh.
I would say arson is the more, like, flashy option people want to think, but most historians say that it was a cigarette.
Listen, cigarettes are bad for you.
Yeah, they are.
And bad for the environment.
Bad for circuses.
Bad for circuses. Bad for things that are flammable.
I'm so proud of you.
Thanks. I have what's today? In real time, today is October 8th, and I have not smoked a real cigarette in almost 3 months.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. Oh, Ryan and I were talking about having a housewarming party, and he was like, all right, so, okay, how many of your friends smoke? And I was like, what? And he was like, how many of them smoke? And I was like, I mean, regularly? I don't think anybody. And he's like, are you not inviting Jenny? And I was like, no. She doesn't smoke anymore. I swear to you, Ryan almost crashed the car.
Oh, he did?
He was like, what?
Listen, I don't do any of my vices lighthearted. If I have a vice, I do that vice.
Yeah.
But I don't smoke anymore.
I'm so proud.
Thank you.
Oh, my heart is a flutter.
Oh, mine is no longer a flutter because I quit smoking.
You can go up and down stairs now.
I know. Now I can walk a distance and be fine. Wow.
Wow.
Okay. Go All right. on.
Anyway.
It's not about me. It's about the circus.
So most think that it was a cigarette. Some point to arson. In 1950, while being investigated on other arson charges, Robert Dale Segee, who was an adolescent at the time of the fire, confessed to starting the blaze. He was never tried for the crime and later recanted his confession.
Was he a scapegoat?
I don't know.
Okay.
They didn't try him. He didn't get, like, any repercussions for it.
Okay.
And then he said he didn't do it and he made it up.
Oh.
And they couldn't put him, like, in that same
there.
Location.
Okay.
So that's much more of a conspiracy theorist.
Okay.
Way of thinking. I think that a lot of people just don't want to think that something this horrible could happen by an accident, and they want to point the finger at somebody. It's like the acrobat.
You need somebody to blame when something terrible happens. But honestly, that's not really the case.
Terrible things happen.
Terrible things happen, and I think it's such an important frame of mind to be in, to accept that terrible things happen, and there's no one to blame, and there's nothing you can do to prevent it.
All we can do is get better.
All you can do is learn and heal.
So my next bullet is this fire did bring about many new fire codes for the circus.
Good.
The circus continued their tour after this. In fact, their next stop was Sarasota, Florida.
Sorry, that's, like, not supposed to be good, but Sarasota holds a place in my heart.
I know, and the moment you said it earlier, I was like, I can't jump to that without telling my whole story.
Okay.
But yeah, their next stop is Sarasota, Florida.
The home of the circus.
Yeah.
Barnum and Bailey.
They discontinued using tents and started doing open stadiums only. And there are photos of them doing open stadium circuses. It's very different.
That works a lot better down in Florida than it does in the Northeast.
Yeah. Soon they started using coliseums and avoiding tents altogether.
Smart.
Yeah. In 2004, on the anniversary of the fire, Hartford held a groundbreaking ceremony for a memorial which stands today where the middle ring of the circus would have been on that day. Now, when people talk about the event, sometimes they'll refer to it as the day that the clowns cried.
Oh, ow. Oh, wait. Why did that hurt my stone cold heart? Ow.
Because your heart's not stone cold.
Yes,
I hate to break it.
Stop
And you.
Ian was like, he said to me earlier, he was like, you are the softest bitch I
know. Oh my God. No, I need to show you a YouTube, or a, not YouTube, TikTok. A TikTok. Yeah, it's, it was that. It was like, she said, I'm not sugar, spice, and everything nice. And then she listed a bunch of other things. And her husband's like, you are the softest bitch I know.
Listen, you and Ian keep trying to out me for being squishy.
You squish.
I'm not squish. You. Do you know how mean I am to people who bully me and my staff?
That's not mean. That's just, like, being right.
Let's quit telling people I'm squishy.
Okay. All right. I regret it. You are Medusa.
Thank you. Appreciate
you will turn people to stone. You very scary.
Oh.
What?
Sorry.
Okay. I'm going to get through my last five bullet points.
Go on.
Okay. My God. Now, in an interesting addition to the story, and my last kind of segment here, is that there are six people who are still unidentified. And five people who are still classified as straight up missing.
Whoa.
One specific child is known as Little Miss 1565. She's a blonde girl, probably around the age of six, and she's wearing a white dress. And even though she has some burns on her face, she's still super recognizable. So it's really shocking that no one has stepped forward to claim her. There is a lot of speculation around Little Miss 1565 because even though they took dental records and did everything they knew in the 40s to help with identification, no one knows who she is. In the 90s, an investigator claimed that she was a girl named Eleanor Emily Cook, and in 1991, Little Miss 1565 was exhumed and moved to the Cook family plot. However, in 2001, Stuart Onan published a book that tore apart the evidence that she was Eleanor, and he says that the dental records didn't match. There is a postmortem photo of Little Miss 1565, which I am kind of back and forth on posting. I don't know if I want to post a postmortem photo.
Do it.
Okay.
Do it.
So there's this postmortem photo.
Postmortem photo.
Thank you. Of Little Miss 1565, and there are photos of Eleanor Cook. And when you put them side by side, at first glance, you're like, could be. Like, yeah, it looks like, I mean, it's a little blonde white girl who looks like she's six.
They all look the same.
Yeah, they're babies. Mm-hmm. However, Gabby from Gabulosis on YouTube made an excellent point that the ears look very different.
Ooh, that's a very defining characteristic.
Yeah, it's something you can't really change. It's not like you can wear your hair different and your ears will look smaller.
You should start taking ear prints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eleanor has really, really big ears. Like, in her photos, like, her little ears are just like, bloop,
oh, sweet baby.
Out here. But in Little Miss 1565, she has very small, like, set back ears.
Oh.
Which make me really don't think that this is her.
Little Miss 1565?
Yep.
Why?
1565 was the, like, Jane Doe number of the time.
Oh, got it.
So that was the number that was assigned to her.
Okay.
At death. But that is the heartbreaking story of the Hartford, Connecticut circus fire of 1944.
Mm, that's devastating.
Yeah. Fires. So avoidable.
So avoidable, yet so prevalent.
What did we learn today? Don't use hydrogen. Don't use paraffin wax and gasoline.
Listen, things that have like a label that's like will explode... will explode.
Yeah, maybe don't put yourself in a situation where you can't get out of that thing that might explode.
Thank you. That's all.
Maybe.
Avoidable life lessons.
Yeah.
Should be intrinsic knowledge, is not.
True.
So, thank you for listening. Don't get blown up.
Yeah, good advice.
Follow us on the social meds.
Yeah, if you have a creepy, ookie, spooky story that you want to share with us.
Ookie, booky, spooky story.
All of the ooks.
Every ook and spook. Send it to us. Slide in the DMs. Email us at alittlebitgrim@gmail.com.
We would love to hear from you.
We would, please. It makes our whole day. We text about it for hours.
We're very annoying to one another about the screenshots that we share with one another. It's very cute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so go follow us, send us your DMs, all the kind of things, rate us on iTunes, or I believe you could rate us on Stitcher too if you want to do that. That would be uber super helpful.
We have leftover glitter. Leave us a 5-star review, screenshot it, send it to us
with an address, and we will send you a glitter bomb. It's a lot
of fun. Shouldn't lead with that. We'll send you a sticker and no glitter at all.
Nope, no stars for you.
No stars.
We're very boring. Stars,
just a sticker.
Yeah, so
enjoy your Friday.
Yeah, be nice to each other.
Be kind. Don't get blown up.
Goodbye.